Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Daniel Foster, news editor at National Review Online. And for Jim Garrity today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. As always, we have good news, bad news, crazy news for conservatives. And Dan, let's start with the good news. Jim and I alluded to this last week briefly when it looked like the Michigan State House and Senate were heading in the direction of right-to-work legislation. Since then, they had passed separate pieces of legislation, and today they are voting and are expected to pass, if they haven't already, identical legislation, which then leaves it up to Governor Rick Snyder, who for the most part looks like he's likely to sign it, but has been somewhat noncommittal, so there's a little bit of drama there. The fact that Michigan, of all states, is heading towards a right-to-work law is phenomenal and probably something we couldn't have even have dreamed of not that long ago. Of course, you've got the union thugs out in full force, state police all over the state capitol, teachers walking off the job to protest the legislation, so nothing new in terms of union tactics, but good for Michigan, a state that's been in the economic doldrums for a good decade, to figure out a smart way to lead the path out.
You hit it right on the head. The law is going to be good for the state of Michigan. It's going to be good for Detroit. On the merits, it's going to be great. And when the president had his little soundbite line yesterday that right to work is the right to work for less money, and everybody laughed and snickered, that's absolutely right. And he needs to learn a thing or two about economics, because that's absolutely right. It's supply and demand. That's the point of, you know, one of the many points besides just sort of personal liberty and liberty of contract of right-to-work laws. But I am a bit of an Eeyore, as you know, and I am worried about, you know, the fallout here. It's not the same political environment that it was with Walker in Wisconsin. And I believe the unions when they say they're going to make life hell in Michigan if this thing gets signed. So I think we're in store for some badness ahead. And I don't know who wins the political argument, but you, as you said, the law itself is going to be good for the state of Michigan.
What kind of badness are we looking at here?
I think you're going to see, obviously, a media blitz. You're going to see strikes. You're going to see maybe marches on the Capitol. It might just be Madison 2.0. And the unions are stronger in Michigan than they are in Wisconsin. So, and also, you know, the president just got reelected. It's not, you know, there isn't necessarily as much conservative energy as there was in the Wisconsin case. It's, like I said, it's a different political environment. Maybe I'm worried for no reason. It won't be the big story that Wisconsin was. And after all, the right won the battle in Wisconsin every step of the way. So hopefully that repeats itself if there is some unpleasantness. But I just, as I said, I'm an Eeyore and I worry about the fallout if Snyder signs it politically.
As a Michigan native, I can promise you this: they will not go quietly into the night, especially in a state where the UAW made out like gangbusters on the auto bailout and everything else. They've got a lot that they're out to protect, and they're going to do everything possible to protect it. So your Eeyore complex is well-founded in this case. Onto martini number two now, Dan, and we've always known that Obamacare was a train wreck, and every time we learn something new that's in the bill because it was passed, thank you, Nancy Pelosi, we find out even more reasons why we hated it that we didn't even know about. So it's just the horrible gift that keeps on giving. A couple more that even some Democrats are even worried about now, up to, I think, 16 or 17 Senate Democrats looking to either postpone or altogether get rid of the medical device tax that would put a lot of medical device manufacturers out of business. That's everything from wheelchairs to pacemakers and everything in between. So lots of different issues there for people who can't expand, can't hire, and cost, of course, being passed along to consumers then, because that's the way it always works when you tax manufacturers. And now the highly touted no more refusal for pre-existing conditions. Well, it turns out you got to pay to not have any more refusal for pre-existing conditions, at least $63 a person for 190 million Americans. So, people were worried about the IRS getting involved here, and it turns out for very good reason, Dan.
Yeah, you know, it's almost as if you want some nice thing to be provided by the government, you have to pay for it. I mean, that's what people are learning, that you can't legislate away market forces. You can't legislate away the cost of things. Covering people with pre-existing conditions costs money for insurance companies, and ultimately that cost will be borne not just in the form of fees like this one, which are built into the regulations of the law, but in terms of higher premiums for healthy people. The sick irony of Obamacare is that it was one of the major selling points to the youth that turned out for President Obama in large numbers again for a second time. And of course, young, healthy people are going to end up paying higher premiums to pay for people with pre-existing conditions. I mean, Nobody likes the fact that insurance companies could turn away people with pre-existing conditions. But what conservatives like to do is not ask, well, is some state of affairs good or bad, but what's it going to cost and who's it going to cost and what rights is it going to trample on and whose wallet is it going to lift from to fix? And that's the question that was asked about this provision before passage. And Democrats weren't really interested in engaging with that. And so you're seeing stuff like this pop up through regulation. And I think that's actually the more dangerous thing that's going on here. And it's a broader trend in government. It's been going on for decades. And it might be the quiet thing that's really killing the constitutional order in America, which is this regulatory state, which is Congress passes laws and they leave a lot of blank lines and a lot of blank spaces in the laws for regulators to come in and fill in after the fact. It's undemocratic. It's not really what the founders had in mind, and it gives exceptional power to the executive branch. So you're seeing that in Obamacare in a huge way. They passed a 1,000-page bill, and really we're finding out that was just an outline. You know, there's more, way more coming in the form of regulation that Congress is going to have no say over.
I think on this issue alone, if you could somehow harness the renewable energy of the founders spinning in their graves, I think our energy problems would be over pretty quickly.
Or just burn copies of the Constitution.
Well, they'd probably get you on the carbon tax then, but, you know, either way, it's still not a good situation. All right, on to Martina number three now on the crazy and a little bit of a scolding here for some on the right. Certainly not all. And this goes back to really last Thursday when we got the surprise announcement from Senator Jim DeMint that he was not going to fill out his term till 2017 and that he's actually leaving in January to become the new president of the Heritage Foundation. A great job and a very prominent think tank. And of course, that set off the huge speculation game for who might be the appointment from South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley to replace DeMint. And last week on Thursday, Jim went through the many different possibilities. As we spent a lot of time focusing on three of the current Republican members of the House delegation, Mick Mulvaney, Tim Scott, and Trey Gowdy. And before I get to my scolding, I just want to play this little clip right here.
I think the three House members you mentioned, all of them would be solid. I think when it comes to budget issues in particular, I think Mulvaney's probably the strongest. If you want to hold people's feet to the fire, Gowdy's your guy, and Tim Scott's solid on everything. So I would be fine with any of those.
So I'm fine with Tim Scott. Here's my problem. After all these decades of Democrats dividing along demographic lines, and certainly we've been very, very critical of the Obama campaign and Obama administration for dividing along class, gender, racial lines. It's been kind of troubling to me, Dan, that so many people, especially in the Twitter universe, seem to be excited about Tim Scott getting this appointment simply because he would be the only black in the Senate and the only black Republican in a very long time in the U.S. Senate. And it seems like we're just heading down the same road that the Democrats are. I think Tim Scott would be a fabulous senator. I think he'd be great on domestic issues. I think he'd be great on national security issues. I think he'd be a great senator. And he happens to be black. And we should be focusing on the fact that he would be a strong senator. Instead, you've got folks like the American Conservative Union yesterday issuing statements to Nikki Haley saying, let's go make history and appoint Tim Scott. We just want a really good senator, and Tim Scott would happen to be one.
Greg, I'm sympathetic with your point of view. I think it's a trap that the right falls into, and you almost can't avoid it because the whole diversity for diversity's sakes game and counting minorities and filling slots and dividing people, you know, and identifying people with their ethnicities, not with their Americanness, say, or any other number of more relevant factors. You might even call it the content of their character. By just sorting people into these buckets, that's kind of the de facto in this country now. And the left has won that battle. I mean, if you go to elementary schools across the country, you hear talk this way. You hear people divided along racial and ethnic lines, and it's an increasingly kind of segregated way of thinking about people and who people are and what makes their identity. So I think there's a deep cultural thing going on here. I think it's one of the, you know, it's a piece of the quote unquote culture wars that we have more or less lost or are losing. And so there's a sore temptation among people on the right to think in these terms, to think about what box can we check off on the right. But I also think, on the other hand, there is a legitimate concern on the right that we want to be a party that includes every kind of American. I mean, the tough thing with that is that we want people to think of themselves as Americans first, as citizens and taxpayers, and mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters, not as African Americans or working class, middle class, whatever. We want people to think of themselves as citizens. But, you know, you also want a party that's representative, and you don't want a party that's stuck in, you know, that's demographically isolated or geographically isolated or whatever. So I think that's a natural enough inclination on the right to want a representative party. I'll tell you, on election night, we were very upset here that Mia Love lost in Utah because we just thought, like, as you said, we just thought she was a tremendous candidate, highly impressive. I mean, telegenic and smart on the issues and really great speaker and all that stuff. And we were upset that she lost. And I was outside sort of with Jay Nordlinger here at National Review. And he said, you know, the left complains and complains and complains that the Republican Party is white, and not a single one of them will ever cross the aisle to vote for a really solid minority candidate who's a Republican. So you see where their priorities are. I mean, the black senators that there have been besides President Obama and his brief replacement there, Burris, the guy at Brook in Massachusetts, you know, I think of guys like Alan West, they're defeated because, you know, for all the talk about the importance of diversity, it's really hard to find a liberal, a white suburban liberal, who will cross the aisle to vote for a black Republican when their stated thing is, well, we want more diversity. We want a Congress that looks like America. Well, cross the aisle then if that's your thing. So, I mean, there's hypocrisy, I think, on both sides on this issue. And it's an unfortunate thing, and I agree with you. I think Scott's just a good candidate, and I'd be happy if he were appointed. And he actually just happens to be my favorite of those three names that you mentioned. Probably it would go in order, Scott, Mulvaney, and then Gowdy for me.
Absolutely. Any one of them would be outstanding. It looks like, at least from the tea leaves that have been out there so far, that the pick probably will be Tim Scott, and I would be thrilled with that. I think he would be a fabulous United States senator, and hopefully he'll be there for a very long time. I think you and I are pretty much in agreement here. There is hypocrisy on both sides, and well, let's try to root it out of the right as much as possible. And you're right, it is entrenched, unfortunately, more and more. Dan, always great to have you with us. We'll talk to you a little bit later in the week.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Daniel Foster of National Review Online. He's the news editor there, and for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join Jim and me tomorrow for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.